We'll begin the webinar with Dr. Lindsay Holmstrom. Dr. Holmstrom is the Director of National Preparedness and Incident Coordination at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection and Veterinary Services. She received her economics degree from Baylor University and her DVM degree from Texas A&M University. Her presentation will provide an overview of the New World Screwworm Response Playbook. Dr. Holmstrom, it is all yours.
Thanks so much, Kristen. So yes, very happy to be here with you all, and we will just jump right in it. So you can go to the next slide. So I'm going to provide an overview of the playbook. I'm going to focus in on the relevancy of the playbook for pork producers. But first, we'll start with just some key reminders of New World Screwworm, because these are key as well for why we developed the playbook and why the response is the way it is. So screwworm, it's a parasite, right? And it's not a worm. It's the fly that lay larvae on warm-blooded animals, usually in the wounds. So it's not a contact spread disease. It's not an infectious or transmissible type of disease. And the food supply is safe. So screwworm is also not transmitted through meat, poultry, or dairy products. So again, very important as I talk here a little bit about some of the activities that are occurring in areas that do have infestation. So you can go to the next slide. And just current situation of what's going on. So as you're aware, we have detections of New World Screwworm in both Texas and New Mexico. So our first detection was on June 3rd. And a calf in Zavala County. And then in total to date, we've had 44 detections. And so half of those, or 22, we've had in cattle. The majority are young calves that have been detected. We've had 14 detections in sheep, 5 detections in goats, and then the remaining 3 detections in dogs, including the single case of a dog being detected there in New Mexico that you can see. So you can go to the next slide. So how are we responding? So we developed what's called the New World Screwworm Response Playbook. So what's a playbook? So you're probably very familiar with the African Swine Fever Red Book, our response plan, Foot and Mouth Disease Red Book, our response plan. We usually refer to the ASF and FMD response plans as Red Books, and that's just, if you open those up on our website, the cover is red. We did develop 2 playbooks for African swine fever that you can go to, and then we went directly to creating a playbook for New World Screwworm. So a playbook is still a response plan. So the intent here was to develop something that just provides that very quick, easy, kind of actionable type of written document, so that very quickly and efficiently states and responders can implement the response activities that are within the playbook. And so the goal of the playbook is eradication. So it's still focused on eradication. And we do have a number of additional guidance documents or supplemental materials that are referenced in the playbook. They're also on our website. And those guidance materials really provide more of the details for certain key activities that are implemented within the playbook. And some of those I'll highlight for awareness and relevancy as I go through some of the key parts of the playbook. So you can go to the next slide. So on the left is summarizing what those key activities are. So there's 8 key activities, but first, just to really hone in on some key points of the playbook. So like many of our response plans, you know, obviously they're focused on animal health, even though screwworm can, you know, can infest humans, right? So all warm-blooded animals. But the playbook is nationally applicable. So meaning that any state, it's relevant for any state to implement as needed. And with that, it's adaptable. So we made it a framework that can be adapted to either the local context of the outbreak, and we talk about different outbreak types within the playbook. It also can be adaptable based on, what's the industry infrastructure, or what's, you know, the density of animals, or where are detections occurring, right? Because it's going to be very different based on density of wildlife compared to the types of producers you might have within these areas. And then with that, it's also flexible. And so we always considered our response plans, including for neural screwworm, as living documents. And so on our website, there's a way to provide feedback that essentially sends you to an email of where my unit receives those emails. And so we're constantly monitoring for feedback. But we know that especially when you develop a response plan and then you start implementing it for an actual outbreak, right? That's no better way, right, to truly exercise a response plan than having to, unfortunately, having to use it. So we are able to revise things as needed based on how the outbreak is going. So for instance, things that we might have written on paper that sounded really good, when you start going to implement them, we see that, oh, we could have made something a little bit more clearer for the state or for producers, et cetera. So just know that we always consider our response plans to be flexible. And so, if there's a policy in there, for instance, that just does not make sense, it's not that we have to maintain that policy, right? We're going to very quickly, especially during an outbreak, make those revisions to do what's needed to support the outbreak response. So there's eight key activities that I mentioned. So just I'm going to focus on the animal part of the playbook, but key activity one just goes through setting up that unified command. So essentially how kind of that federal state response is coordinated within a state section. Our key activity four and five is all about wildlife and the flies itself. So both, how we do fly surveillance and how that gets implemented and where that's going to occur, as well as the sterile insect technique. So releasing those sterile flies. And then key activity seven and eight just focuses on the information flow and reporting. And then finally, the resources. So providing, whether it's supplies, personnel, et cetera. We are actively deploying people, for instance, to Texas right now. The state obviously has a ton of resources that are also supporting the response. But I'm going to focus in on really key activities two, three, and six, which really focused on the animal part of implementing the response. So if you go to the next slide, key activity two and three is essentially summarized here. So anytime we have a detection of screwworm, we'll form what we call an infested zone. So different than a control area that we do for ASF or we would do for FMD, we call it an infested zone. And so that's that yellow colored zone that you see here as an example. And so when we have that detection where we have, neural screwworm establishment in this area, we want to quickly set up this zone, and we're focused on the fly. So there is our entomologists with this response, right, are so critical in understanding the habitat and the ecology of the fly to help us make sure that we're, placing the zone appropriately. But in general, it's a minimum of 20 kilometers around a detection. So that 20 kilometers is very much based on the fly itself. So the fly can fly kind of on average, in a day that kind of 1 to 3, 1 to 5 kilometers. Usually, the females are searching, right, for a warm-blooded host to lay those eggs in those wombs. And so that 20 kilometers essentially trying to form that infested zone where it is, where we actually know that the fly is. And detection of animals is one of the best sentinels we have for knowing that we do have the wild fly in that area. A little bit different with this response than what we would see with FMD and ASF as well, is that if we have new detections either within that yellow area infested zone, in the zone that's right surrounding that infested zone, which we call the adjacent surveillance zone, or within an area that's reasonable for the fly, under normal conditions to still be linked to a current established infested zone, we're going to expand that infested zone versus creating a new one. And so we've had both cases where we have a number of zones that haven't expanded and so have stayed with actually just one animal case. New Mexico is a good example of that. And we've also had zones in South Texas that we have expanded, and Texas Animal Health Commission has expanded again based on having additional animal detections that looks like based on the ecology and whatnot, that it's still somehow associated with that zone. And again, just critical that these zones are really trying to capture where the fly actually is. So very much dependent on, animal inspections, which is critical, that second bullet there, the fly surveillance, et cetera. And then for premises that are either farm-raised animals or wildlife that are under either temporary or permanent human control, if there is a need to move those animals out of that yellow area, out of that infested zone, we do have a guidance document that goes through the details of those movements requirements. So essentially a permitting type of requirement, a lot, a little bit different than probably what we do with an infectious disease. And so we purposely didn't use the term movement restrictions. So we're not intending to restrict movement. It's more just meeting these four bulleted requirements, with the key one being those animal inspections before moving animals out of that zone. Because we really are not wanting to move potentially infested animals that might have the larvae and wound in a wound. And then those larvae will drop off, right, and pupate in the soil, and then a new, population of flies could occur. So we're doing everything, that we can to try to interrupt that life cycle of the fly itself. And so we have guidance documents about those movement requirements, and really it's the key part really is doing those animal inspections before movement. We do allow both individual animal inspections as well as animals that are normally raised in group settings. So swine and pens would be a good example of that, that you are able to accomplish that inspection requirement, observing those animals and within that group setting. And then obviously if you see a pig, for instance, that's by itself, or you see a wound, you might want to do a closer inspection. But all that is outlined out within our guidance documents. And again, our intent is to support continuity of business. And the key thing, we're just trying not to have it where we have new populations of the fly established due to movement as much as possible. So if you go to the next slide, this is key activity three. And so managing infested animals that are on a premises. And so for the most part in this outbreak, it's usually just one animal that has been infested on a premises, although we have had cases where we've had a number, more than one animal infested on the same premises. I think the most we've had is four. But usually it's just one. So again, a reminder that it's not a contact disease, right? So a pig, standing by a pig, another pig that is infested isn't necessarily any greater risk than a neighboring farm, even, that's within that same infested area. But we do have guidance documents about, what do you do if you had an infested animal? So how to manage that animal itself, trying to isolate it as is possible. The reason is not, again, that it's, we're worried about it spreading to other pigs, for instance. It's more we're just trying to make sure we get that animal treated, and trying to make sure that if there was still larvae, for instance, in that wound, we just don't want those animals, running around on a premises and potentially dropping, larvae, around a premises, for instance. But with this, depopulation is generally not, it's not expected at all. So again, this is a treatable condition. The miyasis is very much treatable. You'll hear about some products that are available to be able to achieve that. But if you did need to dispose of an animal, we have guidance on how to go about doing that. So what different options we have for animal disposal. And again, it's doing it in a way where we're trying to make sure that we kill that larvae, for instance, that might be on an animal. But otherwise, we have guidance on other things that might, be required or might, you might want to do, or best practices for handling the premises as well. So if we go to the next slide. Okay, so again, so key thing, right, is knowing what screwworm is, how it might reside in swine and pigs, These are just the top 10 conditions of miasis based on Central America. So data that was pulled by Panama and COPEG. So you see number one, umbilical. That's I think the top one as well currently in the US, and that's in mostly those young calves that are seeing that. But you can see even something as small as a tick bite, right? Potentially could get infested, right? Because that fly is looking for that flesh in order to lay her eggs. But if you go to the next slide, anything with screw worm, you're thinking about if screw worm were to get closer, right, to where we have commercial swine, for instance, or even backyard swine and things like that that might be in these areas. You're really trying to do as much as possible to limit essentially wound-causing activities, or be cognizant if you're going to do that, to do it in a way to try to limit or promote wound healing, or try to limit that exposure to a fly if you were to end up in one of these infested zones. So you can see some of the activities there, tail docking, ear tagging. We haven't had any detections due to applying ear tags, to meet that animal ID requirement in some cases. There's a lot of guidance out there too, right, about if you are going to ear tag to put Purethrin or some other wound healing product for that. But anyways, you can see some of these activities that you would want to think about, right, and see if any of these activities can be maybe not performed in times when we have a lot of fly activity, or at the very least just being aware that if doing something that's causing a wound, or just how swine are raised or whatnot, where they can get scratches on them and cuts. It's just more, again, that animal inspection, being aware of looking for those wounds and trying to look for miasis and then reporting it as soon as possible, which I think was highlighted on this next slide. If you go to the next slide, which I think is about diligence and reporting. So there's a lot of information we have on our screwworm.gov website. A lot of resources there. I know a lot of universities, including SCHIC, have some really, really great resources for pork producers on new roll screwworm. So for the most part, as you're trying to look for screwworm, if you were to be near where we have infestation is detected, we had some actually limited submissions of flies that not from a fly trap, but actually were caught on an animal. So this fly, right, is about the size of a house fly. So for the most part, the focus is really on inspecting those animals and looking for signs of miasis, and then reporting it as quickly as possible. So wound management, again, one of the highest priorities, knowing what screwworm looks like. And so we have a number of, we have like a photo gallery that's on that screwworm.gov website. There's a number of recorded webinars and some other resources that are available to help with that. Again, those animals inspections, checking animals regularly and then reporting cases right away, and most importantly, not discarding the larvae, right, into the dirt or whatnot, or into the environment, because those larvae very much could become adult flies. So if you go to the next slide. So being aware of preventatives and treatments, you're about to hear some great information about that from FDA and EPA. But I'll just refer you again back to resources we have available on screwworm.gov. You can maneuver to where we have the playbook and other activities or resources on this through the screwworm.gov website as well. But there is really a wealth of knowledge on that website that's available for both producers, veterinarians, et cetera. And with that, Kristen, I think I am done. So I will turn it back over to you.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Holmstrom.